my reading today is from Samuel, 2 Samuel, chapter 11, beginning at verse 26. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. Did I start with the right place? Yes, okay. When the period of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her to the palace, and she became one of his wives. Then she gave birth to a son, but the Lord was displeased with what David had done. So the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to tell David this story. There were two men in a certain town. One was rich and one was poor. The rich man owned a great many sheep and cattle. The poor man owned nothing but one little lamb he had bought. He raised that little lamb, and it grew up with his children. It ate from the man's own plate and drank from his cup. He cuddled it in his arms like a baby daughter. One day a guest arrived at the home of the rich man, but instead of killing an animal from his own flock or herd, he took the poor man's lamb and killed it and prepared it for his guest. David was furious. As surely as the Lord lives, he vowed, any man who would do such a thing deserves to die. He must repay four lambs to the poor man for the one he stole and for having no pity. Then Nathan said to David, you are that man. The Lord, the God of Israel, says, I anointed you king of Israel and saved you from the power of Saul. I gave you your master's house and his wives and the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. And if that had not been enough, I would have given you much, much more. Why then have you despised the word of the Lord and done this horrible deed? For you have murdered Uriah the Hittite with the sword of the Ammonites and stolen his wife. From this time on, your family will live by the sword because you have despised me by taking Uriah's wife to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Because of what you have done, I will cause your own household to rebel against you. I will give your wives to another man and before your very eyes, and he will go to bed with them in public view. You did it secretly, but I will make this happen to you openly in the sight of Israel. Then David confessed to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord.
Lord Acton lived between 1834 and 1902. A-C-T-O-N, Lord Acton. He was an English Catholic historian, politician, and writer. And you know him. You've heard from him before, probably. But he's known for being an extremely learned man. He had a 60,000-volume personal library. And Lord Acton is famous for the quote, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Probably heard that before. Lord Acton. And history is replete, it's full of examples of that. We see it and we recall Lord Acton's words, yes, there's a case, another case of absolute power corrupting absolutely. Well, in the time of Israel, they really began to experience this as a nation during, just before and during the time of Saul. So before Saul came on the scene, Israel was a confederacy, for lack of a better word. It was divided into 12 tribes or segments or states. You could call them any number of things. When they came into the land of Canaan, they actually divided it up according to the tribes that they were born in. And they respected those boundaries. But then, toward the end of that period of the Confederacy, Israel was old enough at this time to have begun to experience the failure of that that method of governance. They went through a period, in fact, Judges really chronicles this period of time, where they would give way to idolatry, they would be plunged into war and all sorts of awfulness, they would cry out to God, God would deliver them, they would pinnacle again, and then they would go back into the same valley over and over and over again. And so Israel goes to Samuel, who is their prophet, and they say to Samuel, we want a king. We want a king like all the other nations around us. If we had a king, this would solve all our problems. Well, we know that's not true, right? So Saul is crowned king against Samuel's better judgment. God says to Samuel, give them what they want. That's what they want. You're not responsible for that. Let's give them what they want. So they got a king. And Saul was as corrupt as you would expect. He dies an ignominious death. He's replaced with David, and we really have hope for David early on. David is, after all, the one that went out and courageously killed Goliath, this huge man that had the Israelites trembling in their boots. And early on, David seemed to be a man of character and all of that, but things like being king go to your head. In fact, whenever anybody in any walk of life starts to think that they have some sort of superiority or privilege, look out. Because absolute power corrupts absolutely. And then after David, there was Solomon. And Solomon was even more corrupt. Solomon had a stable full of wives that he gained by political liaisons with the nations around him. He was a politician par excellence. He had horses and chariots and buildings and homes and gold, and people came to his doorstep to pay respect to him. But he was as corrupt as all the others. The sermon today is about privilege, power, and indifference. Things that you will observe in this period we're talking about, but also, if you'll keep this in mind as you read the newspaper, you'll also see it's true today. So I want to go back just to the time of Samuel, and I want to tell you what Samuel said to the nation as he's getting old. To the elders, Samuel warned, the king will draft your sons and daughters. Some will be forced to plow his fields. The king will take your sons and daughters from you and force them to cook and bake and make perfumes for him. He will take 10% of your grain. He will demand 10% of your flocks. When that day comes, you will beg for relief. Samuel was describing for them what it would be like to take a leader on who was more concerned about his own junk than he was about the nation. Altruism is not a word you would use to describe a king. You can see the evolution of this as Saul becomes king and then David. And our text today is a reflection of this self-aggrandizement, this privilege, this indifference to the people around. Because in 2 Samuel 11:1, it says this. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go to war, David sent Joab and the army to fight the Ammonites. When kings normally go to war, David is at home in his palace telling Joab and his armies, you guys need to go fight this battle. So while his army was away, David was out on his rooftop balcony surveying his city, surveying his kingdom with thumbs in his lapels, going, look at what I've got. Look how great I am. I think probably rested in my imagination from his afternoon nap. What was at his disposal? What he, because of his power, could have that was within his grasp. Including the beautiful woman that he saw bathing on her rooftop somewhere in his city. Her husband was one of his soldiers. It was Uriah the Hittite was one of David's soldiers. One of the men under Joab that he'd sent to battle. David was becoming a victim of his privilege. He couldn't probably even see it or appreciate it. That's what privilege does to us. It makes us blind to our own corruption, our own sin. It makes us blind to other people and what they may be struggling with. Privilege separates us and insulates us as individuals. Privilege limits our vision. We become myopic. We become nearsighted so that we can't see the things that are far off. Privilege also makes you feel entitled. And no doubt that's what David was feeling as he wandered around on his balcony. Wow, look what I've got. So David sets in motion his plan to have that beautiful woman that he just saw. There's no consideration of what his decision would mean because, you see, myopic people don't do that. I'm going to have her because I want her. And Bathsheba has no real choice in the matter. He's the king. She's just one of his subjects. And so the message goes out, the king would like to have you come to your palace. And who says no to the king? Who says no, I'm not going to do it? David also knew that she was, that came back in the report, who's that woman over there? He knew that she was the wife of Uriah, but that was no deterrent to him. Even though this was one of the people giving his life for the king, that's what happens when privilege and imagination takes over your judgment. You are powerless to think through those things because you're so consumed by what you think is owed you. And there is total suppression of the virtue, of his virtue. Whatever virtue he had in the past, he suppressed it all, and it leads to lies and cover-ups, which David implements to cover up his adultery and the crime that he's about to commit. I I think I have this. I'll come to this later. But what I grew up hearing was Bathsheba being painted with a bad brush, as people tell the story, which we'll discuss in a little bit. But I don't think that's there. I think we have a corrupt king who's willing to set aside everything that he knows to be right in order to have the thing that he wants, in this case, a person. Well, David would have allowed the lie to persist, except there was a fly in the ointment, and the fly in the ointment was Nathan. Dadgummit, there's somebody that always comes along to mess up your perfect little sin, and it's Nathan. When your conscience is numb to virtue, when there's no end to what you will not do in order to get your way, when we sell out to friends in order to lie or cheat or steal or otherwise exploit ways to bring about our will and what I want. But God was not happy with David. David had a special corner in God's heart. In fact, the Bible says that David was a man after God's own heart. So there was something winsome and attractive and unique about this man, and God could see it, and he was unhappy with David. And so Nathan says, God through Nathan says to David, I want to tell you a story. Stories about this man that had this little lamb, and he loved this lamb. Loved him. Probably the way that Bev and I love our little dog, Bella. You know, I just love the way she looks at me with those big old brown eyes. I just turn goo-goo when she does that. And this man loved this little ewe lamb. And he loved her so much that he let her lick out of his plate, and he poured her stuff to drink out of his cup. And this little ewe lamb used to follow the man around. He just loved this lamb. Had the lamb not because so much of what it would produce for him in terms of wool or milk or whatever, he just loved the lamb. Well, the big rich guy up the street has seen the guy out with his lamb before. And the big rich guy that's got money to burn has got company coming. And he doesn't want to kill any of his lambs. But he's got to feed his guest. And he's rich and powerful, and he has attorneys and power and all the things that you would need like that. And he goes down to the poor little man with his little ewe lamb and says, I'm taking your lamb. And he takes it home, and he kills the man's little lamb and serves it to his guests. It's an awful story, isn't it? I mean, doesn't it just make all the rage inside you boil up when you think about a human being with privilege and power and wealth and resources and all of that goes and takes away from this poor man his one treasured possession? David, that's how David reacted. He was just enraged. And Nathan quietly said, You, King David, are the man. It's you the story's about. Because you've used your privilege and your power to take away one of your soldiers' wife. You're the man. Well, I can only guess, but I'll bet you every bit of the color drained out of David's face. Either that or it became bright red. Well, when interpreters come to the story of David and Bathsheba, some try to wash away the sin of the encounter, like Pilate tried to soap away the guilt that he had for Jesus' death. We've seen that before, haven't we? We try to rationalize things away by attempting to eliminate it or forget it. Forget it happened. One commentator said the book of 1 and 2 Chronicles don't include this story. I thought that was kind of interesting. And the retelling of the history was the chronicler trying to paint David in better light, and so he decided not to leave that, not to put that in there. I don't know. Or maybe treat it like a tragic love story like Susan Hayward and Gregory Peck. And some people have tried to do that. Oh, it was this wonderful love story. David loved Bathsheba. This other marriage, it wasn't working out. And so, yeah. Or better yet, let's just make Bathsheba the guilty party in this. And that's where people try to paint her as trying to catch a fly in her little sin trap on top of her house. Nathan wasn't having any of that. David, he says, you're the predatory man that looked to conquer this unsuspecting victim. You're the one that sent messengers to her to call her to your palace. You're the man. You're like the unprincipled man in the story that would dare to kill the poor little ewe lamb of this poor man. Fortunately, and part of what makes David such a great person is he acknowledges his sin. Doesn't try and cover it up. Doesn't try and make himself look better than he is. There's no stuttering and stammering on his part. There was no saying, I was having a hard day, or I was worried about my troops. None of that. And David realizes out of this sin that there are three things he can't control. He can't control Bathsheba's pregnancy. You know, sin has a life of its own, doesn't it? It just really does. In this case, it has to do with an infidelity, but every sin has a life of its own. It has a way of creeping out of our lives and spreading. It just spreads. It just goes. We hear people talk about victimless crimes and that sort of stuff. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist. Sin has a life of its own. It leaves and it spreads. Number two, he can't control the actions of a righteous man. Well, if there's any humor in this, it's of David trying to control Uriah. And so he calls Uriah home from the front, and he says, oh, Uriah, what? Go home. You know, you've been fighting hard. Go home, spend the night with your wife. David's thinking that they're going to have sexual relations, and then Uriah can think he's the father of this child. But Uriah is sleeping at the door of the palace because he's a man of character. And Uriah says, how can I do that when I've got soldiers under me that are fighting? I can't do that. They can't do it. David can't control him. And he can't control the words of truth spoken to him by Nathan. Can't control the pregnancy, can't control Uriah, and he can't control truth. Psalms 51 is attributed to David. It's this painful passion cry about sin. Wash me from my guilt, purify me from my sin, for I recognize my rebellion, it says. It haunts me day and night. I cannot get it out of my mind. When have you been guilty of sin that haunted you, that took up residence in your head? When your own will was all that you considered in a decision. Isn't that so tempting? Isn't it so difficult? We get something in our mind, we say, there's this thing that I want, and I'm willing, come hell or high water, I'm going to have what I want. When the impact of our decision would create severe pain for others, when my own privilege eliminates sensitivity toward others. You know what? It's one of the criticisms I have of our nation right now. I think we're mirroring the sins of Israel. I really do. And I want to say to political leaders, you're not listening. You're doing things without any concern for what it's going to do to people underneath your leadership, like the man in the parable. If I don't care what happens to anybody but myself, then I'm not fit to be a leader, period. And it breaks my heart to see religious leaders subscribing to that kind of poison. Pardon the political statement, but I think it's so relevant to what we see in this story. David would have been a better man if he had thought about the ramifications of the things that he was doing. If he had thought about the way that it was going to affect others down the road from him. I'd just like to close with prayer. I think this is a powerful, powerful story. And it sort of knocks the breath out of you, doesn't it? Especially the story. Every time I read the story, it just makes me sick. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for your grace toward us. Thank you for the ways that you forgive us when we do unforgivable things. Please give us the ability to see